Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. How are you today on this September 3rd, 2013? This program, you know, is called It's All About Food, and I think if you don't believe that it is all about food right now, at the end of the hour, I am absolutely sure you will be convinced because everything is connected to food. So let's just jump right in and get my first guest on and talking because we've got a lot of things to talk about. David Simon is the author of a new book, Meatonomics. He's a lawyer and advocate for sustainable consumption. He works as general counsel for a healthcare company and serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. David received his BA from UC Berkeley and his JD from the University of Southern California. He's the author of the New Millennium Law Dictionary, a full-length legal dictionary. He lives in Southern California with his partner, artist Tanya Marie, and their rabbit, tortoise, and two cats. Welcome, David, to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thanks very much.
Yeah. So you wrote a pretty incredible book, Meatonomics, dollar sign on the S.
That's right. Just released 2 days ago, in fact.
Very good. Well, I hope it does very well because everybody needs to read it.
Terrific.
There aren't that many books out on quite on this subject. I've spoken with Marion Nestle a few times, and she's done a lot of work connecting all kinds of government issues, politics, actually. She came out with that first book, Food Politics, which was recently reissued, 10th anniversary. And then a while ago, I spoke with Anona Howder, who has a book talking about Foodopoly, the title, with the history of how we got to where we are today with our food system. And you've done an incredible job kind of summing up all of the economics behind our food system. And I want to tell you that reading your book and seeing all the billions of dollars referenced everywhere, it is quite overwhelming.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, isn't it? It's crazy.
It's just so much money and so unnecessary.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so let's check off some of these items here that are in your book, starting with the check-off program. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's just one of these crazy things that has endured in this country and has not really helped.
Yeah, these check-off programs are really incredible. Nobody's heard of them. We're all affected by them, and we see and hear their messages on a regular basis. But very few people are actually familiar with how they work. A check-off program, just like check a box, is essentially a tax program that was enacted by Congress. And they apply to a number of commodities, but in particular, they apply to most animal foods. So there's one for pork, one for beef, eggs, lamb, fluid milk, and other dairy products. The way the programs work is they collect a small tax at the point of wholesale transaction. So the first wholesale buyer, typically like a packing house or a slaughterhouse, remits, for example, a dollar per head of cattle to a central organization, and the funds are spent on promoting the animal food that's covered and doing research on that that essentially helps to convince consumers that those foods are healthy. The reason these programs are so significant in this country is that they are remarkably effective. When I added up the numbers that the checkoff programs themselves boast about, like this is how successful we are, it turns out that on average, for every dollar they collect and spend, they see something like $8 in additional sales.
Wow. Nobody can get a turnaround like that on money.
It's incredible, and what that means is each year they spend about $550 million, and the boost in sales of animal foods that relates to that is about $4.6 billion. It's a massive number. They're selling all Americans who eat these products somewhere between 5% and 7% more of these foods than people would be buying otherwise.
Now, why would the government care to have a program like this?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, you put your finger on another really important component of these programs, and that is they are backed by the U.S. government. In an important 2005 U.S. Supreme Court case, the court held that when a checkoff program speaks, it actually speaks the message of the federal government. So when you hear something like beef, it's what's for dinner, or pork, the other white meat, or milk, it does a body good, that's actually the federal government telling you to buy more meat, pork, or dairy. And your question is a wonderful one. I have no idea why our government would want people to buy more of these products, because across the board, in every demographic, the data shows that we're already eating more than the USDA recommends we do of these products. In every category, men of every age, women of every age, the USDA recommends a certain level, and we're exceeding it in every demographic group.
You know, I know when our country was going through war, at least war that we recognize as war, World War II, World War I, we had all these different propaganda policies because the men were overseas and the women were at home, and we wanted to send the meat overseas, and we all had to learn how to eat differently. And so we were encouraged back then by the government to grow our own food and eat more fruits and vegetables so that the better food, the protein food, could go over to our soldiers. But other than that, I don't know what other than certain people making money, what the point is, why the government would want to go into ensuring marketing of these products. Is there a program like that for broccoli?
There are some programs like this for fruits and vegetables. Mangoes have a checkoff. Mushrooms have a checkoff. Blueberries have a checkoff. But the amounts of money are radically different. There's about $50 million spent on fruits and vegetable checkoff programs versus, as I mentioned, about $550 million spent on animal food checkoff programs. So it's apples and oranges, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's not even a comparison.
Well, I believe that if we were putting some good money to marketing the benefits of fruits and vegetables and encouraging people to eat them, they would eat more of them if it was hip.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, and there, you put your finger on another issue, which is federal subsidies. The ratio at which we subsidize meat and dairy compared to fruits and vegetables is also completely disproportionate. We spend something like $38 billion subsidizing meat and dairy and only $17 million subsidizing fruits and vegetables. That means that fruits and vegetables get 0.0004 of the funds that meat and dairy get in subsidies.
Now, it's very clear throughout your book that you are not encouraging the consumption of meat and dairy, that they're the big evils for many reasons, and I'm right there with you because I'm a vegan. I have been for 25 years, and I'm waiting for everybody to get the message. And some people are getting it, and there are so many angles to approach health and environment and animals and now the economics behind it, which are just incredible. And you always hear the reasons why people don't want to give up meat and dairy. And some of them I think you address in your book, things like people think that if they treat the animals, I'm going to use air quotes, humanely, isn't that better? Is that healthier? Is it better economically? And you've done quite a lot of study here showing that economically it's not a better alternative.
Well, that's right. And in fact...
And environmentally.
That's right. And I'm glad you used the air quotes around humanely, because one of the other things that I look at in this book is how animals are treated in factory farms. And we're used to hearing that there are some ethical issues in factory farms. Listeners won't be surprised to learn that there are some ethical problems. But I sort of found systemic legal issues that go much more deeply than even most informed vegans are aware. You know, for example, there's this concept in this country of something called a customary farming exemption. And what these customary farming exemptions do is they take a formerly robust animal anti-cruelty statute. For example, Connecticut used to have a statute that says it's illegal to engage in cruel behavior toward any animal. And then the legislature comes along and enacts a customary farming exemption, which carves out a massive exemption for all farm animals. So in Connecticut, for example, today, it's, and I'm going to actually read a quote here, it's legal to maliciously and intentionally maim, mutilate, torture, wound, or kill an animal, provided the act is done while following generally accepted agricultural practices. So to paraphrase Connecticut's law, it's legal to intentionally torture a farm animal. And as shocking as that is, virtually every U.S. state has the exact same law in place. They're worded a little differently. And these laws apply to all sorts of things that you wouldn't think. Organic animals that are raised organically, or animals that are raised in cage-free conditions, in free-range conditions, and even in many instances to animals that are raised in humane conditions. So it's just, there's a lot that we don't know about what's going on in these factory farms, and there's so much industry misinformation and sort of attempts to placate consumers. And unfortunately, these so-called humane ways of raising animals just don't really cut it because of these exemptions that exist.
I know many of us want to believe that our government is there to protect us and make sure that we're getting quality products. And most of us just want to trust and not dig any deeper. And we're continually discovering that regulations aren't, that there are regulations. Some of them are actually good, but they're not enforced. We need some regulations, like the thing you just read, are horrific. There's so much out there that we don't know about. And getting back to what I mentioned before about people thinking if they eat more humanely, I remember doing a simple calculation one time, just trying to estimate the landmass on the earth and if we could grass feed all of the cows that were being raised for meat, and I quickly determined we didn't have enough landmass to grass feed without confining these animals. And I didn't even think about chickens. And you bring up this study that was done, and that's the problem. We're eating too many animals, and there isn't room if we were going to let them roam and graze like this image we have in our mind of the idyllic farm, which really doesn't exist anymore. We have to confine these animals.
That's right. You know, many people are familiar with Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, in which he profiles this sort of now famous farm called Polyface Farm, run by Joel Spelaton. And Polyface looks like a great place to be an animal. There's a lot of pasture, and the animals rotate through it. But as I show in the book, that Polyface model, even though it looks nice, it's completely unworkable in this country. If we wanted to raise all of our animals in that sort of pasture setting, we would need something like 300,000 additional farms of that size, something like twice the size of Texas. So the land, as much as people would like to think that buying grass-fed beef or pastured pork or even free-range chicken is a good thing, it just doesn't work. It's not sustainable because the land doesn't exist.
Another thing that doesn't work, when people talk about vegetarian diets being healthier, people are slowly getting that message and slowly weaning themselves off red meat, moving to chicken and fish, and then kind of a little bit getting off of chicken, and fish is the big health food. And everybody thinks they need a little of it or a lot of it, and that it's good for us. And I don't think most people realized the environmental issues where so many fish species today are extinct and becoming extinct. We've got this aquaculture. And there was actually some of the things you were talking about regarding aquaculture I didn't even know. But can we talk a little bit about the fish side of eating animals? A lot of people don't even realize that fish are animals.
Yeah, You're right. You're right. Now, you know, so we have two ways of producing fish in the world. One is capture fishing, which is to go out and fish with a big boat and catch wild fish. Capture fishing has depleted a third of the world's fisheries. These are the major fish stocks. The cod fishery in the North Atlantic has completely collapsed and is closed.
Mm.
And experts predict that by about 2050, if we keep going at the pace we're going, all commercially fished species on the planet will have collapsed. Now, on the flip side of that, we've got fish farming. That's often touted as sort of this, you know, silver bullet of food production, because that's going to be the future of how we produce fish around the world. But the latest science on fish farming also shows that is damaging the world's oceans, because, among other things, fish farming results in a highly concentrated area of fish waste. Often there are a lot of chemicals. Farmers, just as factory farmers dose their animals with antibiotics, fish farmers dose their animals with antibiotics and with other chemicals designed to keep fish lice off of them. And fish farming, sadly, doesn't work either.
Well, the thing that I was surprised to read, that's something I hadn't read before, is all about the emotions that fish have and the fact that they can feel pain, and how some scientific studies are starting to recognize that, even though the studies you mentioned are so horrible, how they figured these things out. And then the other part is in these factory farms for fish and aquaculture, even if we have the technology to make their environment clean, and there are some groups that are doing all kinds of fancy things with technology to filter their water, the fact that they're so confined affects them so emotionally. And that's, for some of us who care about what other species may feel, is one issue, but it's also not good for producing food.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. Fish farms are just the factory farms of the sea, and just as land animals in factory farms are subject to what this concept of hyper confinement, the exact same kind of hyper confinement applies to fish in factory farms. So we find, for example, 27 18-inch trout crammed into a space the size of a bathtub, typically. And as you point out, the recent research does measure how these animals experience these conditions, and fish have the stress hormone cortisol just like we do, and they've actually measured elevated cortisol levels in fish that are hyperconfined, in fish that are subject to the kinds of infestations of lice that this hyperconfinement causes, and in a variety of other scenarios. But yeah, and as you also say, it's true that the latest research now finds that fish feel pain. So this sort of concept of catch and release that some people are fond of,
mm-hmm.
Well, a trout has something like 20 pain receptors in his or her face, and they feel pain just as we would.
Oh, yeah. I'm taking a deep breath here, feeling their pain. You have estimated towards the end of your book that the external cost of U.S. animal food production totals $414.8 billion.
Yeah. Gold. Massive number.
That's a massive number. Now, the biggest part of that pie is healthcare.
That's right.
So I think what you were trying to tell us in this story, Meadonomics, is that the government is subsidizing or encouraging behavior and consumption that ultimately leads to really bad health, and then we have even more expenses to deal with.
That's right. And for people who aren't aware of this term, externalized cost, you know, if I take my garbage to the front of my driveway and leave it there and pay a garbage collector to pick it up, I've internalized my garbage collection cost. But if I drive to a park at midnight and dump it there, I have externalized my garbage collection cost. So what I'm arguing in this book is that animal food producers are basically dumping their garbage in our parks at midnight, and that $414 billion annual total of externalized costs is more than half of what we spend each year on Social Security, just to put it in perspective. It's just a huge number.
Well, this whole concept of externalized cost has really been, unfortunately, growing and thriving, and a lot of corporations take a lot of advantage of it from the top down, passing on expenses to their suppliers and their customers so that they have to pay less and less and they can make more and more. It's quite an interesting process. Now, we've kind of very briefly touched on a number of issues in our food system where we're encouraged to eat a lot of meat and dairy, and it's not cost effective, it's not a good choice for health, environment, animals. Now the question is, what do we do about it? And you propose a meat tax.
That's right. And I know that a tax is controversial, but I think that the mechanism that I suggest is one that's relatively simple and one that could actually work. I propose a 50% excise tax at the federal level on the sale of all meat and dairy products. An excise tax is just like a sales tax. And at the same time, I suggest that we provide on average a $500 tax credit to consumers, which would have the effect of compensating for the additional food budget that people would experience as a result of the tax, so that at the end of the day, nobody spends any more than they do today on food, but the tax causes them to shift a significant portion of their buying from animal foods to plant-based foods.
It's kind of a trick with dollars.
Like it's kind of a trick. But when I do the math, I come up with some incredible benefits from a tax like this. For example, each year that this tax is in effect, we could save 170,000 people's lives. We could save 26 billion animals' lives. We could return to its native state almost 600,000 square miles of U.S. land that's now used to graze livestock or raise crops to feed them, and in the future would not be needed for that purpose. That's like twice the size of Texas. So this tax would have a lot of – we'd also put $30 billion back into the U.S. Treasury, by the way, which could be used to provide food stamps or other subsidies to low-income people or a variety of other programs.
And we have already a very messy financial structure in our government – lots of loopholes, and so many different groups. We don't even know what they're doing, if they're doing them efficiently, or how much corruption is involved. One more tax is, how do we even get that into the conversation?
Well, that's a good question. I knew when I proposed this tax that it wasn't something that we were going to pass right away, but I thought that it would be, now is sort of a good time to start a dialogue about this and put the idea on the table. If other people are interested in it, maybe it could get some legs and some traction. And ultimately, this is how any change has to start. Somebody has to come out and say, this might work, and if people get behind it, it just might. Who knows?
Well, I agree that in order to make change, there has to be some sort of economic incentive. And it's unfortunate, but in our capitalistic system, that's how things work. And most people are not aware of how their food quality affects their health and their lifestyle and all life on Earth. And they're looking for, I think you said it somewhere, now that I'm thinking about it, where people are looking for quantity, not quality. And in order to make change, or in order to get people to move in the direction and buy the things you want and not buy the things you don't want, you have to play with the price.
Well, that's exactly right. We're as a nation, we're consuming twice the meat that we did just 75 years ago. And one of the main reasons for that is that on an inflation-adjusted basis, because of things like this massive externalization of costs that we've been talking about, the prices of animal foods have been dropping.
Mm-hmm.
The price of chicken, if you adjust it for inflation, the price of chicken is almost 80% lower than it was in 1935. At the same time, we, as a nation, consume per person six times more chicken than we did in 1935. That's exactly what the law of demand predicts. The law of demand says as prices go down, consumption goes up. And the only way to change that, or let me, a significantly powerful way to change that is to increase the prices of animal foods, let them rise to what should be their normal level instead of holding them down artificially, and the effect of that rise would be to cause consumption to drop in a significant way.
I just realized there was something I wanted to ask you about earlier, and I didn't, so I'm going to do it now. And that is, in addition to talking about the economics of locally grown food, and you show how economically buying locally is not always the best choice, that some countries can raise animal food a lot more cheaply than other countries, and shipping them from one place to another is not a significant addition to the cost. Is that the same with plant foods?
Yes, the concept of local production requires that we do what's called a life cycle assessment on food in order to determine its carbon output. And the typical life cycle assessment finds that processing, production, and preparation, three P's, account for something like 70 or 80% of the carbon footprint of any food, plant or animal, while transportation accounts for something like 11%. So for any food, while local consumption is good, you know, you want to support your local farmer, the question is actually more complicated if you're trying to determine what is this food's carbon output. Am I, from a carbon perspective, am I better buying locally or from a distant continent? The answer isn't always clear, but yes, it's the complexities can be equally difficult for both plants and animals. I think in general, not being too dogmatic about local consumption is probably a good idea.
Good. And then the other one is about organic, and I wasn't sure if your results were applied also to plant food as well as animal foods, because you show in many cases that raising an animal with non-organic methods is more economical.
Yeah, so the issue for organic also that I wanted to explore in the book is, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm from the organic community to the effect that organic production is environmentally friendly because it results in less carbon emissions and other harmful byproducts like nitrogen and phosphates and the things that enter our waterways. But what I find is that for animal foods, it's really a completely mixed bag, and you cannot categorically say organically producing animal foods is more environmentally friendly than producing those foods in inorganic ways, just because mainly it takes more land to raise animals organically, and it takes more time because they just grow more slowly. If you're not dosing chickens with growth promoting antibiotics, guess what? They grow a lot more slowly, and that means they've got more time in the hen house, you've got to run the lights more, you've got to run the generators more, et cetera.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the program, and I wanted to mention that you are doing a book signing here in New York City next week.
I am.
September 9th?
That's right, September 9th at Moo Shoes, M-O-O Shoes. It's a vegan shoe store at 78 Orchard Street.
And what time is that at?
That is from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on Monday night, September 9th.
Yeah, that's the Moose Shoes is a great vegan shoe store, and the owners, Erica and Sarah Kuversky, have been so wonderful at having a number of different book signings there. It's a great space, and they've been very generous with it. So it should be a fun event.
I think it will be great.
And then the bottom line is we should just lighten up on that meat and dairy, shouldn't we?
We really should.
Yeah.
Even better, go vegan, right?
Go vegan, yay, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm putting it out there, too. Meat tax, whatever it takes.
Yeah,
whatever it takes. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best to you, and great luck with this book, Meatonomics.
Thanks very much for having me, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Well, that was David Simon, and a really good read, Meatonomics. If you don't understand what's going on in our food system or just need a source where it's all in one place, this is a good place to start, Meatonomics. Okay, let's take a quick break, and next we're going to be speaking with Bava Ram, the author of Warrior Pose. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back. You're listening to It's All About Food on September 3rd, 2013. I'm really looking forward to this next part of the program. I want to introduce my next guest, Bava Ram, the author of Warrior Pose. He is a former Network News War correspondent whose career was abruptly ended due to a broken back and failed surgery. Declared permanently disabled, he was heavily medicated and confined to a body brace years later. Came a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer and prognosis that survival was not possible. On the brink of death, Ram left Western medicine, detoxified from all medications, and found mind-body medicine. Through the sciences of yoga and Ayurveda, Ram healed himself and now devotes his life to helping others reclaim their inherent power to achieve profound self-healing, overcome life's greatest challenges, find their authentic voices, and manifest their fullest potential. Welcome to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me, Bava Ram.
Oh, Karen, it's so nice to be here with you and to all of your listeners, and thank you for that nice introduction.
Thank you. You know, I just have a brief little story. I don't believe there are coincidences. I believe that we are shown things, and whether we're paying attention or not, we will take advantage of what's been put in front of us. And I was at the Ben Bella anniversary party back in May in Brooklyn, and I was there because one of their authors, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, is a friend of mine, and he had a book out, and your book was there as well. And I had a lot of books that I had taken that day from the Book Expo here in New York City, and I didn't need another one, but something told me, take this book. Your book was talking to me. And I took it. I took a couple, actually. I gave one to my brother, and I read it, and we both really, really loved it. And just so many parts of it spoke to me, and I really wanted to talk to you, and I didn't know how I would get you on my show. And then I realized at the end of the story you were talking about how one of the things that you did was move to a vegan diet, and I thought, well, there's my food connection, and now I can talk to you on this program. But we don't have to talk about food. We can talk about so many different things, I think. So thank you for the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. You know, and food is either medicine or poison, according to Ayurveda, which is the sister science of yoga. Ayurveda is a Sanskrit word that means the science of life. And what you put in your body obviously creates your body. And if you put junk in, you're going to get junk problems. And if you put wholesome, natural, organic, pure foods in your body, you're going to be much better off. It's just an elegantly simple logic.
It does make a lot of sense. And yet, why is it that so many of us don't make that connection until it's too late or almost too late?
Let me give you my take on that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that food is also what we allow into our minds. and that we have allowed a whole lot of junk food into our minds. Mm. From the very beginning of our lives, when our parents set us down in front of the television set, and we become a victim of mass media. And we become a victim of all of this noise and all of this drama designed to mesmerize our consciousness and then periodically punctuate it with selling us stuff that we don't really need, about which there's a lot said that isn't true in commercial advertising. And our consciousness becomes polluted. And then we make bad decisions to eat these junk foods that are advertised. And the images show people vibrant and healthy and in love and with happy lives because they're having this burger and that supersized cola drink and this other packaged garbage that's actually contributing to the epidemic of obesity and cancer and heart disease and stroke in our country. So we've been brainwashed, is the short of it, by the food that we have chosen to put into our minds through mass media. And that's another important element of healing, because when you are in a state of constant mental agitation that we call stress, then you will buy things to try to get out of your stress. Mm-hmm. And that's what mass media is all about. And when you are in a state of deeper presence and relaxation, your immune system is energized. You're more present with your life, and you make more conscious choices in that state of mind.
Now, the great thing about your book, Warrior Pose, and I really highly recommend it. I read a lot of books, and I don't highly recommend them all. But this one is definitely a winner, and I think personal stories really move people the most. I just had another guest on, and we were talking about the economy and all these billions of dollars we're wasting. And when we talk in the billions, these big numbers, it's so overwhelming, and it's not comprehensible. But when we hear an individual story, it can be very compelling. And yours is just such an incredible story. And it's inspiring because you really went to hell and came back.
Well, I can report now as a former journalist that all of the demons that are in Dante's Inferno happen to be real. Mm-hmm. Because most of them came and tore at my flesh and my soul when I went through my darkness. And I'd be happy if you'd like to recap that story.
Oh, absolutely.
As you said in your introduction, I was a war correspondent for NBC News. My name was Brad Willis at the time. And I had worked my way up to the network through a variety of small, medium, and large market television stations across the country as an investigative reporter. And there I was with the network. I came from a fairly middle-class background, and I was in the big leagues, and I felt a little bit intimidated, and that the best thing I could do was work longer and harder than anyone else. Class alpha male. And that's what I did. But I had a dark secret. In 1986, I had come out of Afghanistan, where I was in the mountains with the Mujahideen freedom fighters during the Soviet occupation. And I took a very rare vacation, went down to the Bahamas, relaxing at the sun. A big storm came up the final day. I was battening down storm windows and fell off a ledge about 12 to 15 feet and cracked the lowest vertebrae in my back. Mm-hmm. I technically had a broken back. I knew that if I got off the rocket that my career was on, that there were 1,000 extremely well-qualified and better-educated people than me waiting to take my seat on that rocket. Mm-hmm. I wasn't about to give that up, because journalism was my whole identity. It gave my life its meaning. And so I worked for 7 years in increasing pain. Through drug wars in South America, revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua, apartheid in Africa, front lines of the first Gulf War. And finally in 1993, when I was in charge of all Asia for NBC, I was on assignment, and that lowest vertebra cracked. Mm-hmm. Started to cut into my spinal cord. But for years during that secret, I had medicated myself heavier and heavier every day. Vicodin and Valium and Prozac, and I drank harder and harder every night, doing anything I could to get away from the scorching pain. And I always told myself, get over it. You've seen so much suffering around the world, wounded children in wars, innocent victims. Your pain doesn't compare to what you report on. So buck it up and move forward. But the day it cracked open, I could no longer buck it up. I was flown back to America for major back surgery. That back surgery failed, and I ended up in a body brace. From my chest down to my thighs, I couldn't sit up to eat a meal or walk without a cane. Tickled on heavier medications now, of course, and drinking even more each night because not only was I in more physical pain, but the emotional pain was something I couldn't even face. I couldn't even acknowledge was there because I had lost my whole identity. I'd lost what I felt was my manhood. I had no capacity to move forward, to be a productive human being because I was so disabled. And I became a master over the next several years of self-pity and a master of anger and fear and blaming everything in the world and withdrawing deeper and deeper into my own personal darkness until finally a child came into my life. My little boy, Morgan, was born. And this was in 1997, just before Christmas. My marriage was very tenuous at the time. I don't know how anyone could have lived with me. I certainly would have cut and run long ago. But
pain
we had
does,
this beautiful...
Pain does terrible things to people.
It makes you a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I confess to that. And I thought, well, I do have an identity. I'm going to be a daddy. And suddenly I started to perk up a little bit. And 3 months later, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and told to write my will. It was from exposure to depleted uranium used by American forces in the first Gulf War to pierce Iraqi tanks. And again, I was on the front lines of a lot of those piercings.
Mm.
I got darker and darker, and the only person in my world became that little boy. And 2 years later, just before the year 2000, as I was very close to my death, he came to me, and finally, in his own little two-year-old way, he got it. Daddy's a mess. He can't even get up in any way. And he trembled. He had little tears in his eyes. And he spoke three words to me that changed my life forever. Get up, Daddy. And Karen, it hit me in a place in my heart that I didn't know I had. And for the next several weeks, it was this mantra looping in my mind, get up, Daddy, but how? I already felt so guilty that I was leaving this little boy's life with the cancer and that I was never a whole daddy to begin with. So I decided I would die with dignity, that that's all I could do. That the drugs had made me such a monster that I had to detoxify and detoxify of all the alcohol. And very quickly, a funny aside of how the mind works, I thought it was okay I was drinking so much. You know why? It was expensive wine.
Oh, it was quality.
That's how we can fool ourselves sometimes.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So I went into a rehab hospital in the San Diego area where I live, and detoxed cold turkey. And over those many nights, that's when all those demons of Dante's Inferno came to me. And at the end, I had no idea what I was going to do. I was truly dazed and confused and in even worse pain because I wasn't on morphine and Vicodin, Prozac and Valium and Ritalin and blah, blah any longer. And they came to me like a lifeline and said they had just started an experimental pain clinic. They couldn't help me with cancer, but maybe the pain. Ancient Eastern modalities with modern Western holistic methods, I didn't even understand. I said, yes, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
The very first day I went into biofeedback, where they hook you up to electrodes to take your skin temperature, your brain waves, et cetera, your heart rate. And they play you a guided meditation. And this voice took me to a place of relaxation that I didn't know was possible. I had never been that relaxed in my life. And I could feel my inner chemistry change.
Mm.
And some lights went on inside of me. I can take charge of whatever healing capacity I might have, I have to play a role.
That's a great feeling, actually, when you realize that you are a part of it.
It's an empowerment.
Yeah.
And I started to move towards that. I went back to the hotel near this pain center, near the Scripps Hospital where I was staying. And I ordered the book of this person, Dr. Emmett Miller, a book called Deep Healing, and had it Federal Express and began devouring it and doing all of these mind-body practices. One of the very first chapters I felt like Dr. Miller wrote with me in mind that said, you have to get over yourself. You have to let go of all the self-pity and the self-doubt and step up. And that spoke to me very deeply, and I started to step up. And a month into it, they started me on yoga. I had never done yoga in my life. The old cynical, jaded war correspondent would have guffawed at such an idea. And the minute I walked into the yoga room, I had the second epiphany after the get-up daddy. I knew I was going to heal myself.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have pulled Brad Willis, a journalist, back, he would have laughed me out of the room. And I went back to the hotel, I ordered yoga books, and I stopped everything else I was doing at the pain center, and I started, except for going to the therapeutic yoga classes, and then back in my hotel room doing these practices, hours and hours and hours a day, and reading and studying. But just a few weeks later, the pain center closed because insurance companies wouldn't reimburse the hospital for the patient care.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people in the program with me committed suicide. Two others went back to drugs, and I went home and built a yoga room in my house. And I practiced 12 to 16 hours a day, only crawling out of my cave to make my little boy breakfast. That would start at 3 in the morning. And then I'd take him to preschool and crawl back in my cave, pick him up, crawl back in my cave, and so forth. And it wasn't just yoga postures. Most of us think of yoga as the postures you might do at a yoga studio or at a spa or a gym. That's a very important part of yoga, but it's only one of many, many aspects. My yoga was massive fasting, visualization, meditation, looking into my soul, finding that power inside of me. Pure organic veganism. I called that my organic chemotherapy.
I love that.
Changing my whole life and changing, as I said before, what you put into your mind is food. I eliminated all mass media from my life. I eliminated all stressful aspects. I was sort of like an animal that crawls into a cave to heal, wounded, this intuitive sense. And to cut to it, 2 years later, I was 85 pounds lighter because I had ballooned up in that body brace, still eating and drinking like a war correspondent, but laying on the couch all day, feeling sorry for myself. And I lost 85 pounds, and I healed myself of cancer. And I still have a broken back, and I have no back pain. I still practice every day as a result of that. I'm not up at 3 in the morning anymore. I get up before sunrise every morning still. And moreover, I feel called, as you also said in the introduction, I feel called to share this power we all have. I'm no miracle story. I'm not a special person in any way. My message is that if someone is dark and confused and doped up and drunk as I was can do this, don't tell yourself you can't. We all have this great power. And we have this magnificent science of holistic living called yoga and Ayurveda that really offers a template of how to get there. So that's what I now devote my life to.
Well, I'm applauding here. Bravo. Bravo, Baba. But I do think you're a special person, and you have a very, very strong spirit. And as a war correspondent, you brought yourself to places that most people would not go to. And you saw so many things and just went to just put yourself in all kinds of dangerous situations. And you did it with an intense focus. So you had, I think there was a shift somehow in your direction, but you used all of the qualities that you had to ultimately heal yourself, the intensity, the focus, once you knew what direction you had to go in. But listening to your story, the shift occurred when your son said, "Get up, Daddy." And to me, that was love speaking, and you let it inside you. And that was like what needed to light your candle or your fire or fuel everything to go in the direction to heal yourself.
That's absolutely true. And love is the greatest healing medicine. Is love is really the essence of whatever any of us might think of as our higher power. And it's the essence of who we are at the heart level. And we've been disassociated from that, given a very fast-paced and stressful culture as well. And coming home to that place can be miraculous. Now, I'd like to add that if you're eating a whole food, plant-based diet, you are being loved by Mother Earth. Because food is really a love story. And if we are eating the food that was made by the Divine Mother for us, there's a tremendous amount of love and natural life in that, and natural healing as well.
I love that. Now, there's many, many people, most people have issues that are keeping them from being the best that they can be. Most people are filled with some sort of self-pity and self-doubt. And it's a very sad thing, because it's hard. It's hard to get out of that.
It is. It's hard to change, but when you start it and you stick with it, you learn that it wasn't as hard as you thought. I think the greatest difficulty is that most of us are fearful of failure. We fear that if we really try to change our lives, that we might not stick with it, and then where will we be? And we don't want our self-esteem lowered even further. And so it's easier not to try. And then we can rely on a whole host of prescription medications for our acid tummies, and things to help us get to sleep at night, and things to help us be more romantic, etc. And we're again looking to the external. And all of those things, as you know, have horrifying side effects, and they don't really help us. They only mask our symptoms. But when we do take charge of our lives, we become empowered. And anyone that's listening to our conversation right now that is in that type of a place, my message is take little steps, loving little steps, because each little step can lead to a small victory. Rather than trying to change everything radically all at once and setting ourselves up for failure and lowered self-esteem again, one little step at a time, because healing happens organically and over time. And the other point I'd make is believe in yourself, because you do have the power. I've had the privilege now of working with literally thousands of students and private clients, and I have seen people facing incredibly overwhelming odds against them, psychologically, emotionally, physically, overcome them through these sciences of yoga and Ayurveda with the proper guidance, who have come to what I call own their power and live their truth. We all have it. It's there. We just need help getting there, and we need to have some faith in ourselves. And a power symbol like my little boy and Get Up Daddy really helps. And I think everyone in their life has someone or something that inspires them to be greater than they are.
I really believe that. And I thank you for writing this book and for all the work that you're doing now. So many people need help. But we do need to make the changes ourselves. But it's certainly helpful to have places to go to guide us and get us on the right path.
It is, and we all have to remember that to be that person that your soul is calling you to be, you have to change the person you are right now. To be that person, you have to change who you are.
Yeah, that's what, when people say let go, you have to let go of the part that is holding you back.
You have to let go of what's not working for you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the images I like to use is that so many of us are like someone in the desert dragging a ball and chain around one leg through the desert and sweating and straining and groaning and absolutely miserable. And then the little sage walks up and says, excuse me, why are you dragging that ball and chain through the desert of your life? And the person says, well, because it's mine and it's locked on my leg and I have to get somewhere. And so I'm pulling it along and it's hard and don't bother me. And the little sage says, but excuse me, it isn't locked. You can take it off. And truly, whatever is holding you down
isn't locked.
Isn't locked.
Yeah.
You can let it go. If it was a splinter in your finger, you would pull it out immediately. But how often do we hold on to old dramas and create new dramas that just pierce our hearts and cause us pain, and we don't pluck it out or let it go? Well, you can let it go. And
there
sometimes
you go. You
might have to let it go again and again and again every day, 100 times a day. But stay with it, and it will work.
Well, thank you for joining me in this half hour. I know most people have issues, and if you need inspiration to solve your problems, Warrior Pose is a great read, and you will be inspired and given a path to follow to heal yourselves. It's really a great, great story, and I'm so glad that you had a happy ending.
I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. All the best. I'm Karen Hartglass. That's the end of the show. It's all about food. Visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my website. And remember, have a delicious week. Bye.